Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Stephen King's The Boogeyman, which apparently I kind of liked and Matt really didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I've been wrong about this before. I don't think I'm going to get that exercised about it. It did very little for me. And it's not a story that's particularly near and dear. It's one of SK's hokiest. It's got an ending that's like straight out of R.L. Stein. But there are a couple things the story does that the movie does not do to its detriment, I think. So that's going to be post-break business. But I think that my ire will bubble up. Will bubble up throughout the plot rundown. I do not have many nice things to say about it.
We'll see if we end up having a reverse turning on our hands here.
Well, if we do, or you know, even if we don't, I mean, I'm not in a bad mood about it. I feel cheerful about the prospect of being on the other side of a turning situation, at the very least. I was just telling you before we started recording that I feel like fucking Pauline Kael when I go to bat for that movie. I you know, am prone to a kind of contrarian verbosity where that movie's concerned for some reason. That movie is, like, pretty bad. But it, you know,
yeah, well,
just tickles my fancy in a way that this movie very much didn't. I thought it was just bog standard.
Sure. Well, the film follows a family.
Family.
I did just recently see Fast 10, so.
I haven't seen one since 7. Since the marathon that we did, actually. I fell off in a major way, although I am given to understand that the franchise did as well. I've also not seen Hobbs and Shaw.
So, Hobbs and Shaw is eminently disposable, as you would expect from a spinoff. Fate of the Furious is all right. I'm a big fan of The Rock redirecting a torpedo by hand. And F9 is dreadful, like, truly. And then Fast 10 is relatively fun. So it's something of a rebound. But anyway, yes, The Boogeyman follows a family. They've lost the matriarch of the family. So it's just a single dad left alone with his teenage daughter and his, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10-year-old daughter, something like that. I don't know, maybe she's a little younger, either way. And there's something going bump in the night in their house, and apparently it is not limited only to their house.
Yeah, it's weird, because, I mean, the boogeyman can go wherever it pleases, seemingly. I don't get too hung up, or I try not to get too hung up on the lore when it comes to this or that boogeyman, this one literally being the boogeyman. You know, it's kind of nice when there is an interesting rule set that the movie slavishly adheres to. You know, like It Follows had a unique gimmick, you know, relatively unique. The Ring, to cite an obviously very famous example. A lot of these movies try to half-ass it, and they lay down parameters that they don't actually commit to and which never make much sense. And so I'm glad that The Boogeyman doesn't do that, but it errs on the side of being too abstract, I would argue. I can't remember how. I remember the rules in Smile being overly convoluted and kind of stupid. So that's closer to a worst-case scenario than this movie. So it's not a feature of the movie that I'm going to harp on about. But it is strange that more than just their house is afflicted, because the climax of the movie plays out like a "we have exorcised the demon" kind of, you know, like ending of a haunted house movie. And it very much is not that. The boogeyman has free reign, seemingly, of basically any dark corner or any closet or any bed in any house anywhere.
Well, it is kind of
spread contagion-like by the Lester character, who is the protagonist of the short story. And I'm going to have more to say about that after the break, I'm willing to bet. So it sort of family hops, you know, in the manner of the Smile demon, but I don't know. It's, again, not something that I intend to harp on about now that I've got it out of my system, unless you have some crosstalk prepared.
Well, I was debating whether or not we wait until the synopsis before I respond. But, I mean, I might be forgetting a scene or two here. Well, okay. I guess it does show up in the therapist's office.
Mm-hmm.
But with that one exception, I'm pretty sure it's just at the two houses.
The two houses. Yeah, that is overwhelmingly the case, yes.
So it's not like, for example, there are a few scenes where the older daughter, Sadie, is at school, you know, high school. And theoretically, they could have had her stuck at school late at night or something. And the mm-hmm. boogeyman shows. And there's none of that.
Yeah, she could have been literally shoved into a locker, which I swore was going to happen at various points throughout the movie, but never did. It sort of happens, but not at school. It happens mm-hmm. at home.
Right. But anyway, we've hemmed and hawed about it. You can go ahead and launch into the synopsis, I think.
So we've got a single dad. We've got two daughters. Their names are Sadie and Sawyer, which I think is making our lives unnecessarily difficult.
Maybe just yours.
Sadie is the older one. And they've both got dead mom stuff going on. And that is a focal point of the movie, thematically and just in terms of screen time. I remember remarking when we reviewed The Pope's Exorcist, is that what that movie was called? How refreshing it was that there was a dead dad who was like a footnote in that movie, because we've harped on about this in basically every episode we've recorded in the past several weeks. You know, horror movies about trauma are starting to run their course. Now, I'm willing to give this movie some leeway because movies are still coming out based on screenplays that were written when this was new and hip and happening, you know. So these things take time. So
right, well,
even if for me the boogeyman is kind of a Johnny come lately, I'm not gonna punish it on that basis yet, but I will run out of patience, you know, in the next 6 months to a year, definitely.
Yeah, I don't know, I can't really justify it. But for some reason the way that this movie is about trauma did not bother me in the way that, say, Smile or any other movie we complain about being about trauma did. I don't know if it's just because there's the whiff of Stephen King about it and I'm willing to give him more of the benefit of the doubt,
mm-hmm.
or if, I don't know, just the nature of the monster in question, the boogeyman. It's just sort of like a feral creature rather than like a smarmy, taunty demon.
Well, that helps. Yeah, it has that going for it.
Yeah, so it is certainly a movie about trauma, but again, it's not as irritating to me as plenty of the other ones.
Well, and
lately.
Especially, it dodges a few bullets, which is especially surprising when you consider how many of the characters in this movie are therapists, because they don't get as, like, there are these awful lines in Smile. I think it's when she goes to visit the guy in prison where he's like, this thing feeds on pain and trauma and fear, you know, and all that.
And
garbage.
Trauma again.
With a side of trauma. Waiter, let that trauma breathe, won't you? you don't get as much of that doggerel as you would expect, which is nice. It is, I would hesitate to call it subtextual because the movie still shoves it in your face, but it's not as obnoxious as some other movies I could mention.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene right up front. Sadie is in the passenger seat. Dad is driving, probably goes without saying. Sawyer's in the back seat. And I was 100% convinced that they were going to get T-boned. It just felt like that kind of horror movie scene. Because the mm-hmm. dad is messing around with Sawyer and not really paying attention to the road. The kid, and this is a thing that recurs throughout the movie, which I both liked and disliked, Sawyer is about to lose a tooth and she's constantly wiggling it around. And the dad is saying, like, I could get it for you. Yeah, yeah, give me that tooth. Ah, come on, come here. And I just thought that a fucking semi was going to, you know, wipe them off the face of the earth.
I mean, we are heavily conditioned.
Yes.
95% of the time that scene happens in a horror movie, that's how the scene ends.
Yeah, well, and that's presumably how the mother would have died. So I just thought, like, we've already got a dead mom. Surely they're not about to fucking eliminate one or more of the kids too. Although I mentioned this now only so that I hopefully will remember to delve into it later. The story is about trauma to a degree, to a large degree, but it's the trauma of dead children. That's Lester's problem, and he's the protagonist of the story. So the story is just steeped in that, and it's a boogeyman story, so that makes a certain amount of sense. He preys on children. So the movie bringing a dead parent figure into it felt kind of askew to me. Lester is a very peripheral figure here, but we meet him in a minute or two. He shows up. The dad operates a psychiatry or a therapy service out of his own home, and Lester just sort of walks into his office, and rather than saying, "What are you doing in my house?" he says, "I don't see anybody without an appointment and an initial phone consultation." You know, he plays it very cool. If anything, a little too cool, I thought. He does eventually make a break for it and phone, I think, the cops to say, you know.
Yeah.
But even then he says, there's a man in my office who's very troubled. Not, there's a man in my house.
Yeah.
The story takes place in an office in, you know, an office building with a receptionist and everything. And I just think that frames the whole thing differently and is kind of to the story's benefit and the movie's detriment that they changed it. But Lester has this monologue, some of which is drawn from the story, which basically takes the shape of a long monologue where he talks about a series of child deaths that he's endured, SIDS, crib death, what have you, and all of them were accounted for, but all of them were tainted with a certain amount of mystery, and he blames himself for them because he did not believe that the boogeyman was responsible. He did not protect his children from the boogeyman. I don't remember how many dead kids he's got. I think in the story it's 3, and he's a shifty looking character. He looks like a paunchy version of like Robert Pattinson's Batman. Or, you know, Robert Pattinson's Bruce Wayne. He's got the, you know, the emo locks.
Well, and it's funny that you should mention Batman specifically, because it's the actor who plays the, how do you characterize him? He's like the Joker's decoy in The Dark Knight.
Oh, like, I knew him from somewhere.
Yeah, I believe the actor's name is David Dastmalchian. Very ominous sounding fucking name. But yeah, he's one of those sort of like weirdo character actors just because of he's got a very distinctive face, and it would be hard for him to play just a normal dude. So he's got to be a weirdo in most everything.
Yeah, he's a classic that guy. The ultimate that guy moment for me is in The Dark Knight when Will Fichtner, I think is the name, shows up. He's like a bank teller or a bank manager in the opening scene. And he's such a that guy that when I watched Dark Knight in theaters in 08, I just assumed that he was in Batman Begins. I mentally inserted him into Batman Begins because he's just such a staple of movies. You know, it's like he could fit in anywhere.
Yes,
he's like a master. What do they call it? A master key. He can fit into any lock.
Yeah, master key, skeleton key.
Skeleton key. That's it.
Yeah, and he's also the one who was graced with the gift of being able to say on screen, "He's got space dementia."
I mean, yeah, that alone would get him into movie Valhalla. He's enshrined forever as the space dementia guy.
Yes.
So Lester, while the dad is on the phone, phoning the fuzz, the older of the two girls, Sadie, is wandering around the house, and she sees that there's an artist's study. What would you call that? A studio?
Yeah, studio.
That has been kind of trashed, and she goes into the supply closet, and the dad rushes in after her, jump scare, and then an ancillary jump scare where the door swings shut and we see that Lester has hanged himself. Cue some rigmarole with cops showing up, and Sadie somewhat bafflingly says, like, "How do you know it was suicide?" I'm
not sure why her mind would be going there yet.
Mm-hmm. Unless she thinks her dad is a murderer. I don't, it's like,
it's, no, it's, it yeah. is a bit of a head scratcher to have that line there. It's a line that would have made a lot more sense if Lester died like 60% of the way into the movie.
Right, after Sadie has done some of the sleuthing that she's about to do. Part of the reason I was thrown by that line and by the subsequent scenes of sleuthing is that the girls, and Sadie in particular being the older of the two, are really the protagonists here. I was expecting it to be the dad on the basis of the opening 10 or 15 minutes, but he really kind of recedes into the background. And so her saying something like that, it's a weird thing for a supporting character to say. Had the movie done a better job up front of positioning her as the main character, it might not have been quite such a head scratcher. It would still wouldn't have made logical sense, but it would have made a kind of dramatic sense because it's a protagonist-y kind of question to ask because she's the one who's going to, I don't know, take action and figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
This business with the loose tooth that Sawyer's been wiggling around comes to a head. Well, first, Sawyer encounters the boogeyman in her bedroom. She's got, I guess it's a nightlight. She spends a lot of this movie, as the Twitter meme has it, pondering her orb. She's got this really bright, spherical, I guess, nightlight, this, like, palantir that she just rolls around the house for.
Well, I think it's supposed to be the moon. Mm-hmm. It looks to have sort of a crater art on it. So it's just like a moon nightlight that you hold as opposed to having it hanging from somewhere or mounted somewhere.
So this is put to use in a few scenes where naturally it's the scene's only source of light illuminating spooky hallways, but not well enough. Right. It comes into play in this scene as well. Afterwards, she goes to her older sister, and her older sister does the old trick where she ties a thread around the loose tooth and ties the other end of the thread to a doorknob and says, okay, on the count of three, I'm going to slam the door shut. And this is a nice note, actually. It's the one mom moment in the movie that landed anywhere near my feels. She said, you know, this is how mom always used to do it when I was your age, or words to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like the way this played out at all. She is standing with the door wide open, hand on the knob, one, two, and the little girl is sort of losing her nerve. So I figured, okay, dollars to donuts, she's going to close the door, you know, swing it shut, and something will be standing behind it. Instead, she lets go of the knob, the door swings itself shut, yanking out the tooth, and the little girl is like, well, you said you were going to do it on three. And I was like, this is beneath the boogeyman, you know, just driving a minor wedge between these two siblings. What he did was rude, but actually helpful. It's what Sadie was planning to do. He just went about it in a boo gotcha kind of way, but it's like it's sub Beetlejuice behavior. I didn't like that at all.
Yeah.
And the tooth comes back eventually. There's a scene much later where Sadie gets jump scared by the boogeyman and he shoves a claw down her throat, and then she comes to, oh, it was just a dream. And then some scenes later, she winds up regurgitating the tooth.
Yeah, the scene of the jump scare where the fist or whatever, the boogeyman appendage goes down her throat was very dumb because she gets like tackled through her bedroom door.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all very abrupt. But on the other hand, I did appreciate she's like having friends over, or would be friends anyway.
Yeah, we'll get frenemies. Into that. They don't even qualify as frenemies. One of them is just a venomous bitch to her every single scene she appears in. We elided a bog standard bullying scene where she's walking down the high school hallway and it's very like, I'm just a kid and life is a nightmare. And she's wearing her mom's dress and this blonde queen bitch is like, are you sure that's a good idea? What do you mean? Do you think it's haunted? Like, and then she twists the knife in her about like, don't you want to move on? And it turns into a shoving match. Then she shows up later in the movie in the scene that you were just about to launch into, and they do more than shove each other. There's slapping and catfighting and the aforementioned shoved in a locker scene, in a matter of speaking.
Right. So they spark up some weed, and apparently Sadie is not a smoker. So when she takes the hit, she just coughs her brains out. But then she, like, keeps coughing in a sort of inexplicable way, and she hustles to the bathroom. And then she coughs out this thin thread. And as soon as it dawned on me what that was, I was like...
See, I'm of two minds about the tooth stuff, because the emphasis on it obviously calls to mind the tooth fairy, and this is pointed because, and we haven't touched on this at all, this movie, in terms of its rules, is very Darkness Falls, and, you know, Darkness Falls does not have a monopoly on that sort of thing, but the entity in Darkness Falls, a pretty bad movie about which I'm a little bit fond just because the trailer for it spooked the hell out of me when I was in middle school. Speaking of Vin Diesel movies, I watched the trailer under the Coming Attractions heading on the DVD for Triple X, and it fucking traumatized me. Several sleepless nights thanks to that thing. Anyway, she's called the Tooth Fairy in that movie, and there's a lot of tooth stuff in this movie, and like the thing in Darkness Falls, the boogeyman is confined to darkness and is deterred by light. That's fine. I think the tooth gets a little too much attention, given that teeth are so closely associated with just a different childhood nursery rhyme figure. You know, I mean, I liked it at first when she was wiggling the tooth around, because it does call to mind the tooth fairy and puts you into that nursery school mindset where maybe the tooth fairy's real, maybe the boogeyman's real, maybe Santa's real, you know, it's all part and parcel of the same kind of headspace. But the boogeyman weaponizing the tooth, it just felt like it was outside of his wheelhouse, and I don't expect anybody to care about that being stuck in my craw, because, you know, because who gives a shit?
Me included, Matt. Yeah. I can't follow you on this one.
Well, be that as it may. Speaking of the Darkness Falls stuff, that aspect of the movie is made plain when Sadie goes to visit Lester's widow. Well, she just goes to Lester's house and then finds the widow squatting there. It appears that their electricity has been turned off because the house is full of candles, which is sort of creepy because this woman, who is a little bit nuts, or maybe more than a little, is just using whatever light sources she has at her disposal to keep the boogeyman at bay, and she winds up firing a shotgun over Sadie's head because she thinks that the boogeyman is standing behind her.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get the cat fighty kind of slumber party scene where, you know, Sadie just invites over all her bullies, you know, to get stoned, and then she winds up getting shoved into the studio where I think that she sees the boogeyman. It was very reminiscent of the scene in The Sixth Sense where Haley Joel Osment gets shoved into the closet and is terrified, let me out, all that. She does get out, slaps the queen bee, and then gets into it with her dad. There's a line that I didn't care for where the two of them are feuding about their mutual bereavement. And at one point, the dad says, "You don't know how I feel." And I just thought, like, that's the line that the kid should say in a scene like this. Invariably, that's supposed to come out of the teenager's mouth. But whatever. She winds up going back to Lester's house. I think she's summoned there by the widow. She must be. I think the widow has a plan for beating the boogeyman.
Yeah, the widow that calls her because she left her phone number on a whiteboard in the house.
And the plan is Donald Pleasance's gambit, straight out of, I want to say, Halloween 5. Which is, or whichever one it is, where he grabs the little girl and is like, "Here, Michael, come get her," you know, ringing the dinner bell, basically.
I want to say that's 4 just because 4 was better than 5, and I want that to be part of 4, but I honestly can't remember.
Yeah, could go either way, frankly. She's sort of jerry-rigged this shotgun trap, which does fill the boogeyman full of lead, and this is the best glimpse we've gotten of him so far, albeit he's only lit up one frame at a time from the shotgun blasts.
Yeah,
which is neatly done, and it doesn't work because you know, you could roll the clock back all the way to the original Halloween. You know, you can't kill the boogeyman. You know, that was true of Michael Myers. It is doubly true, triply true of this actual supernatural entity. He goes down momentarily, but then gets up and makes short work of Lester's widow. And
tears her in half, I think.
Sadie gets out of there and is frantically calling her dad, who is in the midst of returning to the house where they live. And she's like, no, you got to get out of there. It's not safe. And so now the stage is set for the climax. I was thoroughly checked out at this point. It ends in a big conflagration, as all these movies must, where the boogeyman is seemingly defeated by fire, but more so defeated by the redemptive power of love, because the mother's spirit also has a role to play in all of this. But truth be told, I was only half paying attention by that point. And then we get an epilogue in the therapist's office. There was a semi-pivotal scene. It definitely features in the marketing very heavily earlier in the movie with this same therapist, where she subjects the younger of the two girls to this, like, she, like, puts her in an epilepsy chamber, basically. She's, like, subjects her to this strobing red light that's supposed to help her conquer her fear of the dark. This is after her first run-in with the boogeyman. And needless to say, it's kind of like the shotgun shells lighting everything up one frame at a time. When the lights cut on and off, you see fleeting glimpses of the boogeyman drawing nearer, and that's okay. We are back in that therapist's office, and there is an epilogue which is sort of lifted from the story, but divorced from its original context, where Sadie, why does she go back into the office? Did she, like, forget her hat or something? What was happening at that point?
Something with the therapist's voice, and I think we can safely conclude that it's meant to be the boogeyman and not the therapist herself.
Yeah.
Just calls her back in, like, hey, Sadie, could you come here for a minute?
And right. That's
Sawyer
that's right.
And Pops just continue heading to the car or wherever. So, yeah, she heads back in, and she's just kind of looking around, and she can't see anybody in there. And then she sees a closet door ajar, and then suddenly the therapist is on the other side of the room, kind of behind her, and says, did you need something? Which is reason number two why it probably wasn't the therapist in the
first
place. Yes,
most definitely.
And Sadie either says just like no, or she doesn't say anything at all. And then she slams the closet door shut, cut to black. And then we have end credits rolling over a hunk of burning love, which
yeah,
was
that,
slightly
that threw
cheeky.
Me. It was, well, just because, I mean, I wasn't joking when I said that the boogeyman was beaten in equal part by fire and by the redemptive power of love. I already had that line planned, and then burning love started playing over the end credits, and I was like, fuck off. I was just getting trolled at that point. But a lot of horror movies these days have overly cheeky end credits needle drops. I didn't like the one in Barbarian either. Barbarian was a better movie. But it's funny because I had the exact same experience with both of them. I watched both of them on these like shit bucket pirate streaming sites. You know, they were both movie theater camcorder situations. And in both cases, they cut the instant the credits start to roll. In the case of Barbarian, so in both cases, I just had one note to go on and I knew what the song was. In the case of Barbarian, the last frame of that movie is a gun firing, and it's very punchy, and it's punctuated by boom, cut to black. And I just heard the first note of dun, you know, not dun dun. That first dun was all I needed to go, like, oh my God, Be My Baby. That's, yeah, okay. Cause mom, yeah, all right, that's fine. I don't know. So that was, it's largely my own fault for even watching movies in that debased format, but only being given a fraction of a second of both of those needle drops somehow made it more of a slap in the face. But for that, I have no one but myself to blame. More after the break.
It's all just in your head.
Mm-hmm. There's something in my room. You believe me, don't you?
There's no such thing as monsters. You need to grow up!
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
You're both having these manifestations. What is this supposed to be?
It's the thing that comes for your kids when you're not paying attention.
You have to listen to me.
Okay. I'm listening. Sweetheart, let me handle it.
And we are back. So, I think the thing that I liked the most about this movie, and maybe it shouldn't be such a heavy weight on one side of my critical scales, but for whatever reason, it really elevates this movie for me. The film's craft when it comes to showing the right amount of the boogeyman is very adept.
Yeah, I'll give it that.
I've harped on about this in any number of podcast episodes, any number of real life conversations with Matt and with anyone else who will listen, you know. Once you see too much of these monsters, creatures, demons, what have you, once you get too good of a look for too long, too many times, what it was, however the math shakes out, you eventually accrue enough exposure that it just doesn't work anymore, because fundamentally
you've been immunized. It's like getting a booster shot, a boogeyman booster shot, and it just bounces off your immune system after that.
And the only exception that jumps immediately to mind, and it's just because it's a different, much simpler thing, is in A Tale of Two Sisters, the scene you have of the one sister in her bed. And then she just sees the ghost in, like, the opposite corner of the bedroom. And it's just there. And it just keeps coming closer. And you're forced to look at it for, like, 2 minutes straight.
Yeah. Pulse does something similar.
And Pulse does something similar, too. I call it the Japanese girl ghost exception.
It is the exception that proves the rule. There are others, but they are in the minority. The Thing, of course, all or most of the attacks in that movie happen in well-lit rooms, but you're just counting on those insane Rob Bottin effects to save the day, you know, because if the creature is novel enough or horrifying enough, then no amount of exposure could possibly be sufficient. It also helps that The Thing is different every time, so you never can get that inoculation.
Yeah. And you do, like, right at the end, you get a decent look at the boogeyman, and it's not terrible, but not great either, but it's late enough in the game that they have passed the point of maximum danger.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't like Smile, but I did like the creature design right at the tail end of Smile, and Boogeyman falls short of that standard. So it's disappointing on that basis. But those are two movies that I could basically take or leave to be charitable. So it doesn't really make that much sense to pit them against each other. Although I have now more than once in this episode.
Yeah. But anyway, I just appreciate the fact that really until the last 5 minutes of the climax or so, you see just enough of the boogeyman to be like, "Ooh, what the fuck is that?" And no more. And usually, particularly with studio horror movies, they usually miss that mark completely. So
they often do, yeah. And it helps, of course, that you've got the motif of stay in the light and you'll be safe. You know, the boogeyman dwells in the darkness. Again, for me, all roads lead to Darkness Falls. The creature in that movie, in theory, does still give me the creeps. The execution, for the most part, in the movie is pretty inept. But I honestly think that, you know, I mean, and you like this movie, but you have been down on some well-reviewed horror movies of a recent vintage. We both have. We both didn't like Megan. We both didn't like Scream 6. Both movies that did well on the Tomatometer. This movie did respectably well on the Tomatometer. I honestly think that if you just dialed back the butt rock quotient in Darkness Falls and it came out tomorrow, it would get like an upper 60s, low 70s on Rotten Tomatoes. I think something strange has happened with critical consensus around horror movies. Horror movies used to never be able to get a fair day in court, and now
they're being graded on a curve somehow.
Yes, very weird. Anyway, the creature in Darkness Falls is conceptually fairly spooky. Every time you see it, it's just this dark, ragged shape, this sort of billowing black thing whooshing around. And ultimately, you are shown too much of it, and it's just kind of stupid, and they shoot at it a bunch, which is...
I see you, bitch!
In this movie, Lester's widow says, "I see you, you son of a bitch." And I was like, ah!
Somebody's been watching Darkness Falls.
I doubt it. I fucking doubt it. So it falls short of that standard, too. Although I shouldn't underestimate the degree to which that XXX DVD did me dirty. And so I am a little too easy on Darkness Falls, although it is broadly a pretty bad movie.
Yeah.
So the short story, not a great short story, got a very goosebumpsy ending, like I said. Although the ending does do one thing I like, which I'm going to talk about in a minute here. But the bulk of it is just Lester's monologue. And it's a story about the boogeyman, and that's a hard sell in a story for adults, you know, adult horror fiction. If it were a Goosebumps book, it would be more palatable right off the bat. But part of what makes it work, and one of the threads in the story that I respond to, is that, and this is a very quintessential Stephen King thing, Lester is just casually racist and not like in a gentle way, in like a really kind of hateful, vicious way. And that makes it strands you in this kind of awkward position as a reader, because on the one hand, this is a story about the boogeyman and it feels like you're a little kid being told this campfire story. But on the other hand, just based on the language and the hate speech, it's obviously a story with an adult reader in mind. So what are you playing at, Stephen King? You know, do you really expect me to become scared of the boogeyman? Me with my mortgage and my, you know, and so on. And the story's ultimately not that scary, but it is, like I said during the plot rundown, steeped in the tragedy of all of these slain children. And that's something the movie does not have going for it. Evil Dead Rise, we reviewed recently, and I was even a little bit lukewarm on that one, although I did basically like it. That movie killed kids, and I was not expecting it to. I thought for sure it was going to pull its punches where those little Baudelaire orphans were concerned, and it didn't. And I don't know, I feel like in order to capture that aspect of the story, Sadie or Sawyer would have had to bite the dust. And
probably the movie... Sawyer, let's be honest.
Yeah. So the movie's a little toothless in that regard, although I know I never like give horror movies, I never really want to punish a horror movie for not killing kids, because, you know, who wants to see the kid die? I think it's a bit of a...
Just the end of The Conjuring.
Yeah, or just, you know...
that has been my long-held belief.
Yeah, true that. But it does get astray, I think, from what makes the story kind of unsettling. And as R.L. Stine as that ending is, it does do one thing that I like. And this is the second time I've done this in the last, I want to say, 5 to 10 episodes. I'm going to actually read to you a brief excerpt from Stephen King. Let's see. First, more broadly, I mentioned during the synopsis that the story benefits from being set in more of a doctor's office setting with a receptionist and so on. And the reason I say that is because it plays out more or less like the ending of the movie, but much creepier, I find. Lester leaves the psychiatrist's office having been told to make an appointment at the front desk. He goes out and the desk is unoccupied. And then he turns back and goes into the office, and the office is also empty. And so you get hit in rapid succession with, like, vacant desk, vacant office. And it just has this kind of nightmare logic where it, like, all of a sudden you're in public and all of a sudden you're alone and vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And in a way that you couldn't have anticipated. And that's something that the movie doesn't tap into. And here's how it ends. And there's one thing that I like about this, even in the midst of the goosebumps mire. The room was empty, but the closet door was open, just a crack. "So nice," the voice from the closet said. "So nice." The words sounded as if they might have come through a mouthful of rotted seaweed. Billings stood rooted to the spot as the closet door swung open. He dimly felt warmth at his crotch as he wet himself. "So nice," the boogeyman said as it shambled out. This is so stupid. It still held its Dr. Harper mask in one rotted spade claw hand. So the thing about the mask is dopey as hell. I like "so nice," though, and I don't know why. It's such a weird thing for the creature to say. And it's not like a mantra that appears earlier in the story. It just shows up three times right at the very end. I think that's just, I don't know, a really off-putting thing for a monster to say as it advances upon you. And Stephen King, even in his more hokey stories, usually finds a way to introduce some ingredient like that to just get under your skin that little bit and sort of put some kind of a spin on it. And that this movie was lacking in spin for me. I did feel like it was just very, very middle of the road, very run of the mill.
I do find it kind of fascinating. I had never read the short story.
The boogeyman has been the doctor the whole time. That's what makes it a goosebumps.
Right, right. And I do find it kind of fascinating that they took the boogeyman shell and turned it into, if not the protagonist of the movie adaptation, then at least like a secondary protagonist.
Right. Like, and it's
odd.
Yeah, the whole thing strikes me as a little odd. I mean, it's a real flimsy peg to hang your hat on. You know, it's not a story that was crying out for a feature-length adaptation. I do think that the ending doesn't hit the same that far removed from the Lester scene in the first 20 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one kind of has to follow hot on the heels of the other in order for them to, I don't know, feel like a complete movement, a complete sequence. But the setup is like an old joke, you know, like a man walks into a therapist's office and then the payoff is straight out of an episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark? It's very old school, but with just that little wrinkle, the racism, and then the weird catchphrase that sort of keep me coming back to it. I don't know. So yeah, not racist enough. The woke mob has claimed another one. You heard it here, folks.
Lester stepped back into the therapist's office and then man door, hand hook, car door.
Basically, who was phone?
Shit. Yeah, I will also say that despite being generally favorably disposed toward this movie, I also didn't think much of the ending. I don't know what else I would... I mean, sure, we could have killed one of the kids or whatever, but I just don't know. The movie kind of wrote itself into a corner.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else it was going to resolve. I don't think anything about the movie up to that point even necessarily really set itself up for, yeah, one of these kids is going to die. I mean, it would have made sense, but just, I don't know, tonally, this never felt like a movie that was going to kill one of those kids.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't really want it to do that, but when kids are in peril, and especially when they're being hunted by the boogeyman, there is only one way to escalate it. And if you're not going to shatter that ceiling, then, I don't know, you got to bring the scare factor some other way, and that was largely absent for me.
Yeah. So my point being, if you're not going to kill one of the kids, you have to have them kill the boogeyman, at least, you know, temporarily, as it appears to end up being.
Well, it's just good business sense, you know, for any horror movie to, because they often make money, sometimes a crazy amount of money. Smile made an obscene amount of money. It just makes good business sense to leave the door open, in this case, literally, for sequels, you know. So,
well, although technically the boogeyman's... she did close the door before it cut to black.
That's true.
But
it's getting
yeah.
closer. The flames are now licking my body.
One thing that we didn't touch on that also got under my skin and apparently didn't do anything for you, or I think you would have probably mentioned it, is the boogeyman periodically talks with a human voice.
Yeah, that felt like vintage creepypasta in a way that I liked, at least in theory. I didn't have any issue with that.
What it reminded me of, and this is going to be the second time I've referenced this movie in as many episodes, and God knows how many times over the life of this podcast, but it reminded me of the scene in Annihilation where, and for my money, this is the most terrifying part of that film, where the team is hiding in a house from these weird animals, monstrous animals, and one, it's like a weird bear hybrid that screams like a person.
It screams like its own prey. The implication, I think, is that it's screaming the scream of the last
thing it ate.
It devoured. Yeah, right. It's assimilated her.
Right. And it's definitely scarier in Annihilation. I'm not giving the boogeyman that much credit, but I did get just a little bit of that juice.
Yeah, it's got that same anglerfish thing to it, where it's like trying to reel you in. It is a scary feeling, because it makes you feel like a prey animal. Like you could be outwitted, like a fucking fly landing in a Venus flytrap or something. And then you get eaten by a big monster. It does get into something kind of primal.
And I also like that the boogeyman can't seem to sustain it for long periods of time. It'll do it for like a little while, and it'll start choking on its own phlegm or something. It's like...
mouthful of rotted seaweed, as the case may be, which is the other note in the ending that I like. Very evocative.
Yeah. It's almost got a little bit of a... sort of a thing going on. But yeah, I liked the thing all the way around. So that was another point in its favor for me.
I'm not that down on it. Even what ire I had I spent so quickly that even I hardly noticed. And I can never rule out the possibility that these movies are, you know, these movies are, it's more than a possibility. These movies are disadvantaged by being watched in the format that I often watch them. You know, I think the last movie I watched in theaters for the podcast was Skinamarink. They're not all shit-ass camcorder rips. Many of them debut on streaming services, in which case I can track down, you know, a legitimate or an illegitimate HD version relatively quickly and painlessly. But in this case, some of the finer points of the mise-en-scene might have been lost on me. And I freely own that. Last note from me, I forgot to mention my least favorite detail of the tooth pulling scene, which might have been the low point of the movie for me overall. When the door slams shut of its own accord, we get a shot of the tooth bouncing off the ground in slow motion like a bullet casing in a John Woo movie. I guffawed when I saw that.
I
didn't care for it.
That's fair. That's fair enough.
I'm not going to recommend Darkness Falls, A, because it's not good, and B, because I'm pretty sure I've recommended it before.
I think you may have.
It not being good didn't stop me, but two reasons are reasons enough, I guess, to not recommend it. I don't have one in the chamber. Feel free to take it away if you do.
Well, I'll take a stab here. Speaking of movies that made an obscene amount of money, horror movies, particularly when compared to their budgets, I'm going to recommend Lights Out.
I've still only seen the short, not the feature.
The short is better, as is often the case with these things, but I think the feature is fine. It does have the advantage of being, I think, when you cut out the credits, like a very lean 76 minutes.
Nice.
It's certainly not impossible to be bad at that length, but it does seem to be a little harder. But anyway, the basic premise of Lights Out, and this is something that it at least seems to have in common with the Boogeyman up front, and then it turns out the mechanic of the Boogeyman is a little different as the movie goes on. But basically, when you turn the lights on, the monster or demon or whatever the hell you want to call it kind of blinks out of existence, basically. And then you turn the light off, and it can move again, and it keeps getting closer.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a red light, green light thing.
Yeah, and then eventually you usually get bit on the ass by the fact that you lose control of the lights. That's really how the mechanic kind of culminates. But as I said, the short film is better, but I think the feature is worth watching. So I'd recommend both. And you could watch them both in less than 90 minutes together.
can't knock it on that basis. There's a short film based on the Stephen King story from the 80s, so they're basically contemporaneous. And it is a straight adaptation of the story. It's really a story that was made for the short film format. Goofy ending and all, the movie is a very faithful replication, retelling, even down to the rubbery mask coming off, which is just so fucking Scooby-Doo, it kills me. And I enjoyed it, and I do recommend it. It's from 80, 81, 82, somewhere around there. Let's see if I have a feature in my back pocket. There's a movie called The Boogeyman from like 2004 or 5. Didn't scare me. I'd never seen it, but the, you know, the trailer, box art, what have you, didn't spook me the way that Darkness Falls did, but I was at the age where I was always intrigued by horror movie posters and so on. Even if I was too chicken shit to actually watch them, I know that you went through a similar phase.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious to watch it now, see if I like it more or less, roughly the same amount as this one. It belongs to that era that's kind of epitomized for me by Hide and Seek, the you know, Robert De Niro, Dakota Fanning movie. I remember seeing a TV commercial for that movie's DVD release that was trumpeting the fact that it had 5 alternate endings. And even as a middle schooler, I was like, oh, that sucks. Like, this movie was troubled. Like, why would you have that many endings? You know, a story should not be able to end that many ways, you know, and they can't all be equally worthwhile. Anyway, I'm now suddenly hankering for a double feature of those two. Can't recommend them, obviously, having not seen them. But that's what I'm going to do at some point in the coming weeks. Have me a sit down with Boogeyman 04 or 05 and Hide and Seek. That's not a fucking recommendation. whatever. Watch the Boogeyman short film. That's all I got for you, folks.
Fair enough. Well, the Boogeyman has been doused in turpentine and lit on fire. So provided we keep all of our closet doors closed, we might be okay for now. Until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later.
While I referred to a Japanese girl ghost exception in the same train of thought as A Tale of Two Sisters, we are fully aware that the film is a Korean one. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Boogeyman official trailer, 20th Century Studios, uploaded by 20th Century Studios. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, July 2nd, and we will be discussing Malum, a remake of the 2014 haunted police station film, The Last Shift. See you then.